Blog Talk Radio.
Held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting ourselves together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've never been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore. Well,
don't you let nothing, nothing
stand in your way.
I want you to listen, listen
to every word I say, every word I say.
Ain't no stopping.
I want you to get ready for God to bless you and get ready for a door opener. Tonight, we're talking to Reverend Ben. Dr. Ben is talking to the Jewish rabbi, and the Jewish rabbi is talking racism talk, and Dr. Ben is going to straighten the Jewish League out that have been talking about racism and white supremacy. So we got Dr. Ben coming on tonight, and Dr. Ben going to talk about divine healing, and Dr. Ben going to talk about racism in the Jewish community. Now, this is the rabbi from Israel talking to Dr. Ben. Dr. Ben is from Africa, and he was the first Jew, and show you how racist the Jews is towards blacks right now, the American Jews. And Dr. Ben is going to bring that out. It's very important for you to listen tonight. You'll learn something. But this is very important, what Dr. Ben is talking about and what's going on within the black community and what's going on with this racism, white supremacy. So we know that Americans have hooked up with Israel, and it's a lot going on. So tonight, this is divine healing. I think it's the healing of the mind. And I want you to listen to this, because it's very important for you to understand what's going on in America, why we're behind, why 6 million Jews got $1 trillion, got money from America and for the Holocaust, and black, our ancestors didn't get nothing. So it's a political thing. And right now, America send thousands of dollars to Israel. Thousands of dollars. I mean, tanks, planes, all of the modern equipment Israel had. And some whites got American citizenship and they got Israel citizenship. So they got dual citizenship. This is real talk I'm talking tonight. So I want Dr. Ben, this is the Jew from the Defamation League. And he's going to try to show Dr. Ben what Dr. Ben, and Dr. Ben got too much information for him. We're going to hear it now.
I've been a rabbi for 9 years and I've seen the countless numbers of bar and bat mitzvahs in my congregation. But I must tell you that never have I heard a Jewish child commits himself that there shall never be another Holocaust, that takes upon himself political obligations, takes upon himself the responsibility to fight for
this. Is the Jewish rabbi talking about Dr. Ben? I want you to listen carefully, and Dr. Ben hasn't responded yet. This is the Jewish rabbi trying to tell Dr. Ben he's wrong.
A girl in America, the practice tends to be a 12, according to Talmudic law. She reaches her majority at 12 and a half. The bar mitzvah ceremony most specifically indicates that a Jewish child, a minor, now has reached that stage in life where he is considered an adult Jew in terms of his religious and communal responsibilities. Any statements that are made of commitment by bar and bat mitzvah children or adults as they enter the adult world in the Jewish community are statements of acceptance of the yoke of the commandments, of all that comes with the Jewish life, personal, family, communal, and under no circumstances are there statements of political content. But if I could perhaps clarify this a bit more, Dr. Ben then indicated in the transcript, as it appears, that this very statement of loyalty that's made to the state of Israel is the seedbed out of which comes the charge of dual loyalties. We ask ourselves in the Anti-Defamation League the following question. Why would anyone offer such a blatantly false and frankly perverse statement of what it means for a Jewish community to celebrate a religious ceremony of passage? The answer, we might suggest, is the next sentence, which indicates the charge of dual loyalties. This statement was made many, many times throughout the entire transcript. It led in one of his remarks to a statement in discussing about Israel that now we understand about the genocide of the Hebrews as they entered the land. The commitment of a Jewish child to fight for Israel reflects the genocidal entrance of the children of Israel into the land in biblical times. Not only does that have a distinctly political ring to it, it is again an unacceptable statement, if only from the point of view of biblical scholarship, which very clearly has come to understand that those sections that speak of a victorious march of an army of onslaught into the land are certainly later sections of the text edited as kind of national poetry. But if one reads the second book of Samuel in the Bible, one reads very clearly a different version of the immigration of tribes slowly into the land, the entrance into the land, the settlement with other peoples. And indeed, a close reading of the text will indicate that even during the times of King David and King Solomon and after, many non-Hebrews lived side by side with the Hebrews in the land. In effect, there was no such genocide. There was no such destruction. And to even raise the thought that a Jewish child indicates his loyalty to the Jewish people in the context of that historical statement and it's applied in terms of the Jewish present is something that, frankly, insulting is, I think, an apt word as far as we understand it. If I may just add one other part to this. The transcript would indicate that Dr. Ben, in his concern for the need in the black community for cultural and ideological structures and unity, which is obviously a laudable and praiseworthy goal, then proceeds to redefine Jewish history and biblical history in a way which may be conducive to his political view, but does violence to history. He refers to Judaism as originating in Africa, that all of Judaism comes from Africa. The reality of the biblical text, one has merely opened it to read, is that Abraham comes from Mesopotamia. He comes from the area which we today refer to as the Fertile Crescent. Indeed, what we refer today as Judaism, the religion of the Jewish people, reached its full maturity not in Egypt, but according to many scholars, after the first exile in 586 BCE, back into Mesopotamia. The need to rewrite history of other people in order to create a cultural infrastructure for oneself does neither justice to the one whose history is being rewritten, nor the one who pursues the worthy goal of cultural structures. And therefore, to tie it up, we find most disturbing the factual mistakes that are replete in this transcript, but of more compelling concern, the ultimate dual loyalty, genocidal, militaristic implications of the state genocide, we say, in the reference to the biblical genocide, so it appears in the transcript, that is the term that's used, of the children of Israel as they entered the land. I would certainly not subscribe to such a term. The very fact that it does appear attributed to Dr. Ben in the text, we find to be absolutely, again, insulting and unacceptable.
All right, Dr. Ben, what is your response?
By the way, I have to let the rabbi know I'm not a Jew as he is. Born of a Jewish mother, a Yemenite grandmother, a Yemenite Puerto Rican mother, Ethiopian Hebrew father, with Israel. By the way, they call us Falasha for whatever their reasons. But I am as much a Jew as the rabbi or the grand rabbi in Israel, any of the grand rabbis in Israel. If the rabbi is stating here that in the book of Genesis there is no mention of the extermination, and I use the word genocide, of the seven tribes of the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Moabites, the Jebusites, he in his own statement stated that this is ameliorated somewhat in the book of Samuel. Everybody saw that. But the book of Samuel doesn't change the book of Genesis. And we remember that Genesis wasn't written first. It was Exodus. It's at the Council of Jamia that they decided to write Genesis next. Since there is no Jewish race, you know, you have Indian Jews from India, or Persian Jews, look like any Indian. You have ourselves from Ethiopia. By the way, the rabbi wouldn't forget that it says Moses married the daughter of the high priest of Ethiopia, or Cush. Being a rabbi, you will know this. Moreover, about the Bar Mitzvah, and I went through one, like the rabbi went through one, at around the same period of time. There's a rabbi saying that the Bar Mitzvah is not a commitment to the people. Isn't the Torah demanding? And I don't talk about the Talmud. Talmud is not Torah. The Torah is supposed to have been written by God or passed down, although it was in fact written at the Sanhedrin. The theory, the mythology, the allegory that was written by God or passed down by Moses, again, that's Jewish mythology. Because Moses is dead in around 1196 before the Christian era, whereas the Sanhedrin doesn't release a thing called the Torah until about 700 before the Christian era, which was written from 700 before the Christian era to 500. It took 200 years. There's a commitment in anybody that any child that's been Bar Mitzvah, when he's talking about circumcision of women, that is strictly Western, and it has nothing to do with orthodoxy. They're using the word orthodoxy to mean something. There's not been a circumcision. It can't be a circumcision of young girls, but anyhow, it will continue. The point is that in the Bar Mitzvah, it commits the boy. Wait, if you commit yourself to the community, there's a call to return to Israel. There's a call that every child I went through, that you must come back to Israel. If that is not Jewish organization, sometimes they didn't recognize that we exist as Palestinians. It is something in America. American Jews have decided that they're going to speak for all Jews, and not only for all Jews. Remember, they said blacks and Jews. I'm black and Jewish. You're white and Jewish. You're European. You have European Jewish ancestry. I'm African Jewish ancestry. No more claim to Israel than I have, because there's no Jewish race. Okay, let me continue. The rabbi forget, he says that Abraham, he points to Judaism coming from Abraham. Then I said that the rabbi obviously have not read the Ten Commandments and their source. The text, Moses is not until about 1346 before the Christian era, 49 years after the death of Amenhotep IV, otherwise known as Akhenaten. Every one of those 12 so-called commandments and that Moses is supposed to have gotten at Mount Sinai, by the way, Mount Sinai is still in Egypt, in Africa, hasn't gone anyplace. Now, those 10 commandments were gotten by Moses. Because I'm Jewish, don't mean that I have to follow the mythology. When you go in any of the major tombs in Egypt, you find those 10 commandments plus 32 more, otherwise referred to as a negative confession. Am I to believe that Moses was born in Israel, Egypt, about 1346 before the Christian era, went to school there, become a priest, at age 85 or around there, decided that somebody was feeding his people, and that in every school in Egypt, you have to recite the negative confession, 42 laws, of which they said, I have not killed man or woman, I have not stolen this, I have not, every one of the so-called Ten Commandments is already stated that Moses didn't see it. I would like the rabbi to tell me, where does it show that Abraham taught any of this? I would like the rabbi to tell me, before circumcision in Egypt, where did the Jews have circumcision? They said that Abraham's circumcision is part of what made him a Jewish. Then the rabbi must tell me, the worship of the golden calf, which they call the golden calf, isn't that the worship of Hathor, the goddess Hathor? We could go on down.
Well, before we go on, Dr. Lynn, let me just intrude. We do need to take a commercial break. We'll pause for breath, and we'll return right after this. Criticism to Dr. Ben that was voiced by Rabbi Salter is that you suggested that there is a political overtone in the ritual of Bar Mitzvah, and he objects to this. Can you substantiate your statement?
Bill, if you went to any Bar Mitzvah, there's a lecture after the young man and before the young man. There's a lecture of the young man's commitment. It is a lecture of my commitment. Every child, if the rabbi speaks to me and tells me that the rabbi doesn't get up and get a lecture about the Bar Mitzvah, and the youngster doesn't pick out a section of the Torah to read, and that the youngster doesn't get up there and make a commitment to the Jewish community, then I don't know what form of Judaism. I don't know if it's Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative, or whatever else they may be. But it would be rare to me not to go to a Bar Mitzvah and not hear the rabbi mentioning the commitment to the Jewish people and to Israel. If, in fact, that rabbi is, unless the rabbi is anti-Israel.
Yes, I think there are a number of things that must be made clear, and the level of misstatements in this are also quite clear. You just repeated, as appeared in the transcript, the statement that the Bar Mitzvah boy picks out his selection for the morning. But it's rather common knowledge and Jewish practice of centuries that there is a set cycle of the reading of the Torah and the Haftorah, and Bar Mitzvah children under no circumstances are in a position to pick and choose their Torah portions. Their portions are part of the set calendar prescription of which portions of the Torah progressively are to be read on a given Shabbat, a Saturday morning, so that even on this factual level, there's a disturbing lack of accuracy.
European Jews don't write Judaism. You don't make Judaism. Among the Palashas, among the Jews from Christian Jews, we pick. You see, Judaism is run by you. You don't set the standard for Judaism.
So now we're in the process of a double standard of selection. You have indicated in your transcript that this is what occurs in American synagogues
too,
by indicating that the Jewish children make this statement of loyalty to Israel. Yet when I clarify your statement about how Torah readings are selected, you tell me, well, there are other practices aside from the practice here, which may indeed be true, one example being the triennial cycle of the reading of the Torah. But then you can't take the American example and then selectively learn from it something that you choose from
the child context. The child, the Jewish child, doesn't read the entire sermon of the era, the period. He does select a section within that period. That's all I said. If the child doesn't read the entire book or the entire thing that is going to be said on that particular Shabbat, the child has a section within it he reads.
And there are indeed many synagogues, especially in the Orthodox community, in which the entire section is indeed the entire parsha.
So then you're admitting that there is divergence between the Jewish synagogue right here in America
within the prescripted calendar structure of
reading. All I said is that the child is allowed to pick out. You're saying in the Orthodox, in certain Orthodox, not all, the child must read the entire thing. I'm saying that the child is allowed to pick out this section. What is wrong with that?
According to your transcript, and I will take time to find the exact words unless it's required, you make a statement that the child may pick out sections and you use the term Isaiah or from whatever.
Depending on the period of time in which we are.
Depending if Isaiah is indeed part of that.
Who said that? You just brought in other words, I said exactly what you're saying, that the child is allowed to pick out that section. Let's say that we are reading the book of Isaiah now, or we're reading the book of Isaiah. The child is allowed to pick out of Isaiah a certain section, or the child is allowed in Hosea if we are reading at that particular time, because all the children know me by me in the same month and at the same time.
One should be clear, however, that that's partially accurate, because part liturgically of what a child is expected to read or participate in, if possible, is the reading from the Torah itself. Indeed, the reading from the Haftorah is a significantly later development, precisely because if the child is a bar mitzvah, is a son of the commandments, then one of his first public possible acts is being called up to the public reading of the Torah.
Right.
And it's by this act that he's reaching adulthood. Is publicly declared. If I may, however, go on to
let's settle this before we move on. And then
all right, there were some other points.
Oh, yeah, I think we'll get into all of that.
Your response, Dr.
The point is, everyone, I stated, is adulthood. The question is not when does he do this, if he's a man or a child, because assume, I already stated, the Torah would be similar in essence to the confirmation of the Christian. When the child comes of a certain age and take up his manhood, he's, in order to be able to sit in the minyan, to sit in the official congregation of a young man, he has to come and go through the bar mitzvah before he can sit in the minyan. Now, that he doesn't deny that. All I'm saying, and what you can't refute, is I'm saying about later changes. I don't care what the changes are, it's later or earlier. The fact is that they do it.
A very curious kind of contextual oversimplification here. On the one hand, Dr. Ben correctly points out certain instances of Egyptian historical input in what we today call the religion of the Hebrews and later Judaism. And no one can deny the role of cultural and historical context. On the other hand, given it would seem your political need to view all through the African perspective, you completely ignore the experience of the Code of Hammurabi, of the Mesopotamian sources of law, which appear significantly modified in later Torah development. What I'm suggesting is that, on the one hand, it is a strange scholarly position to argue that historical context must be accounted for in the development of Judaism, which I would accept, and then argue, however, that only that political context which is useful to your present political view is to be noted and is acceptable. As I read the transcript, as I read the transcript here, there is a comment here that says, and permit me to paraphrase loosely, that Judaism and all of Judaism and the Jewish people come from Egypt, therefore they are African And therefore, there is a statement later on that many blacks do not understand that they are indeed Jews. Now that raises to us a very curious question: why the constant need to inject a racial quota into a diverse historical context, which we would acknowledge, but yet on the other hand, as we sit here having watched Operation Moses and the ingathering of Ethiopian Jews into Israel, why then the need to define by race as what is essentially authentic in Judaism strikes us as a contradiction that at least can possibly be interpreted in terms of current political context.
Abraham alone and his little family, from Abraham and
according to Torah, for approximately 400 years, everything the Jews owned was in Egypt, everything. Because from the time of Joseph, Exodus, Genesis ends, and Moses died. And it came a time when Moses Joseph died. Because of this bad period of king, we knew not Joseph. From then on, we have to hear about the plight of the Jewish people and so forth. But before that, from the time of Potiphar, all the way down to the Exodus, isn't it everything the Jew learned was in there? It was no Hammurabi code. And I said the basic foundation of Judaism, one God and all that, came out of Africa. Egypt is still there, not in the Middle East.
Time for another break. We will continue with our discussion, our modest discussion, right after this. Press on. Let's please. A number of points. Again, we're into this historical selectivity, and at the risk of sounding as if I'm pushing Mesopotamia today, the reality is, of course, that both the archaeological and the literary evidence of such areas as Ebla and others clearly illustrate that a proto-monotheism existed in the Mesopotamian area centuries and centuries before the Hebrews. Some scholars have even attempted to identify one of the Mesopotamian names of this god as Eloah, and in that way try to learn from it the Hebrew term Elohim. And I merely identify this as one scholarly view. Again, I wouldn't want to deny for a moment that Egypt is part of the cultural mix, and therefore Africa, as you would want to make the political point. But to selectively ignore all other historical factors to then be able to make a political point is not to be dismissed as a cry of anti-Semitism when it's raised, but is to be called for inaccuracy in the historical record. And one has an absolute right to do that when that inaccuracy then leads it to contemporary politics. But if I would like, but if I could return to the Ethiopian issue.
No, we don't. I've got to answer you that point first. Then you could go to the Ethiopian issue because that's the biggest you do.
Mm-hmm.
You tried to throw over that anti-Semitism slipping right there. Mm-hmm. Even when a Jew disagrees with a Jew, it becomes anti-Semitic. By the way, I hope that you would agree that the common statement in America among Jews is that if your mother is Jewish, then you're Jewish. Would you agree to that?
According to Jewish law.
Okay. And make it better if your father is Jewish and your mother is Jewish, then you're
Jewish. Excuse me, one's father has nothing to do with
that. I said extra measure.
Right, but that has no...
I didn't say that. Don't be peculiar. I mean, we're dealing with the issue. I said, well, okay, my mother is one, so that makes me it. Yes, okay, fine. So then to call me anti-Semitic, I'm a Jew practicing, went through all the rituals like the lady who probably did on yourself, then it would mean that I strongly disagree with the teachings that what you just stated, for example. Then I said to you, using the Torah itself, on the statement of the Torah that Abraham came from the city of Ur in the nation of Chaldea, which was at the time, since we're using by history, ruled by Africans, a joint army that went all the way to India. Now you said scholars. There's only one scholar that made that remark that I know of, and that's the one from the Stern Institute over there in Lexington Avenue. Now, secondly, there may be continuation of those scholars coming out of European context. What you fail to understand, Rabbi, is that European Jews are European and think as Europeans. And act as Europeans. African Jews, on the other hand, are being asked not to act as Africans and African Jewish scholars, African scholarship. And what you're telling me with the scholars? Now let me go.
Are you finished addressing his last part of that more? All right.
Last part of his point. The period of time in which we're speaking, and unfortunately, Torah doesn't give dates. But the period of time in which we're talking about Abraham or Abraham isn't born until around 1775. BCE, before the Christian era. That would put him around the 13th century, a 13th dynasty, Egyptian 13th dynasty, Ethiopian 13th, the dynasty of the Nile Valley as a whole, because it's not only Egypt. Egypt is a region of a culture that goes way back, because the ancient Egyptians themselves said, we came from the beginning of the Nile where God had to dwell. All of those things. For instance, look, Rabbi, the myth that the Jews built the pyramids. Do you know that's a myth? It is taught, probably you say to yourself, God gets up there and he goes and starts on the pyramid. Pagan gets up there. And you know pretty well that the last pyramid was built before the birth of the first Jew, Abraham. Now, if I say that, I'll be anti-Semitic.
All right. In the interest of fairness, Dr. Ben, let's hear what Rabbi Salter has to say.
What's disturbing is simply the level of misunderstanding of what we're saying is that the scholarly view that I identified and which you've been identified as a Stern College view, Stern College is part of Yeshiva University, an Orthodox institution. My background is in the Reform movement. I assure you that much of what I've suggested in terms of biblical scholarship would be totally rejected and considered unacceptable by the Orthodox community as representing non-rabbinic analysis of Torah. Therefore, to dismiss my remarks as being represented by Stern College raises the question of what kind of comprehension we have here of scholarship and indeed the pluralism within the Jewish community. And that leads me to the point I want to make. In the transcripts and in your remarks now, there's a tendency to speak of all Jews in the broadest context, so that you began with the Ethiopian issue by speaking about Israelis, then switched to white American Jews. And as I listened to you, I heard a constant tendency to put everything in the category of white, European, versus black, Sephardic, Oriental. And again, I asked myself the question, the state of Israel, which has a population today which is 60% Sephardic,
right,
non-European, who at the bottom of the social ladder, Steve, please, I listen to you, with a population which is 60% non-European, a population coming from the Middle East and the Oriental countries, it is certainly a political charge, which we hear constantly and is used constantly, that Israel is a white European colonialist bastion in the middle of an Arab third world part of the world. But the reality is that Israel today increasingly takes on the Levantine quality of the area in which it's in, precisely because of the population. Side point, but let me
first
say,
let me give you 1 minute to press your point forward, and then Dr. Ben can continue. I must say that the time is evaporated.
Fine.
And that is my concern.
Proceed.
1 minute.
Well, I shall try 1 minute. Again, this attempt to say that only black Jews experience difficulty in Israel. There are a number of, frankly, inaccuracies in this. When Soviet Jews began to come to Israel, there was precisely the same kind of questioning raised by the rabbinate. Since the rabbinic establishment and authorities were in disarray in the Soviet Union, were indeed these people who were coming Jews under Orthodox law. It caused political problems. Ultimately, it was worked out, as the issue with the Ethiopians is a problem, will be worked out. To characterize this on a racial basis is totally unworthy of what is indeed going on today in Israel.
And he speaks of the multiracial characteristic of Israel, but he didn't say that the multiracial characteristic isn't visible in the control in Israel. Israel is controlled by a European, European-American, and British factor of white Jewry. He doesn't want me to deal with this reality. I've been there in time.
Is that true, Rabbi?
I would give you two quick answers to that. That historically, yes, because of the nature of the earlier immigration.
Okay.
At this point in time, given the past election results in which Likud, which was heavily representative of the Sephardic community, and Labor, which has its base in the European community, ended up in essential parity. The reality is that power is increasingly shifting from total European control to indeed what is considered a parity between the two communities.
Well, it would seem to be a simple question, Rabbi Salter. Do Jews who are European or white control Israel, or do Jews who are African control Israel.
No, it's not that simple, because we're dealing with, no, not at all, because we're dealing with the question of process. And the question of process simply indicates that the initial migration of population out of which the state of Israel was established was European. The governmental structures were created by these people. Immediately after the creation of the state, over 500,000 departed Jews from the Middle East, from North Africa, were brought into the state while it was involved in a fight for independence. These people took the obvious number of years to be able to function effectively on all levels of government and all levels of Israeli society. Time is a necessary factor in life, but as of this point today, one can say without any hesitation that the non-European Sephardic community wields tremendous power in the state of Israel.
Who is a dominant power?
Who is a dominant power? Again, I would indicate that by the last election, in which both Likud and Labor ended up in what is essentially a dead heat, one can learn from this that there is no one group in power anymore.
Dr. Ben, the rabbi is saying to me that if I went to Israel, you went to Israel, that most of the people in government, the ambassadors probably now are not European American and British Jews. Am I to believe that that's what he's saying, that there's an equal division of power? I can't think that the rabbi will stay there and say this and give a this kind of a evasive answer to the question. British Jews still dominate the politics of Israel, still dominate the economy of Israel. And is he saying to me that these people are non-cultural? My point to him is, regardless of what rabbis may have said, did they demand that the Jews from Russia go through a new halakha? Do they reconversion? Do they demand a brisk? Circumcision.
Such were the demands.
Were they carried through?
And just as, and the parallel is a very important one, just as politically the intent of the Orthodox, let me finish please, just as politically the intent of the Orthodox rabbinic establishment could not be considered acceptable, and these demands were ultimately dropped with Soviet Jews, so one finds that as the Ethiopian Jewish community grows, the rabbinate itself has been forced to back down, and I think it is a very clear statement that most Israeli
wait a minute now. I got a cut for a commercial break.
I know you're hot. Both hot. Hot program. Hey, this is the last segment you can't run over, and I'm going to chop you if you do. We can't resolve your philosophical, your political, your historical, your ideological differences, clearly, this hour. But maybe we can address ourselves to tone and intent. Obviously, the letter that was written by the ADL objects to the tone and suggests that there may be some premeditated, sinister, injurious intent to Dr. Ben's remark for political reasons. And perhaps you can clarify that, and perhaps Dr. Ben can rebut and answer, and maybe perhaps we can clarify and heal this rift.
As we read the transcript and as we discussed today, we see much in your remarks that is reflected in third world political statements in the UN and other forums. The fact that you are indeed Jewish in no way changes the content of these remarks and the political context in which we see them. From our point of view, as Ethiopians were starving and are starving, Israel was the only country that offered the kind of aid to physically bring black Ethiopians out. And indeed, it's the only example of a nation of Caucasians, to use the term that appears frequently here, of bringing in whites, bringing blacks in dignity as citizens. To begin to turn it around says to us, we begin to hear the same kind of third world radical political kind of rhetoric, which is directed toward the United Nations, towards Israel and the United Nations, which we hear in so many other forums. This is what we respond to, this willingness to identify Jews and Judaism with colonialism, whites, repression, and having read some of your other material in addition to this, I must say that it's a theme that strikes me as pervasive and something that we find unacceptable in a public forum.
All right. Number one, you spoke very much about generalized statement. You just said that the Ethiopians are starving, and you bring it up. Isn't it the fact that you're talking about only, Ethiopia has about 40 million people. You're talking about 5 miles from the border with Sudan in south, where the starvation situation developed. Isn't it also a fact that the Palestinians, the Ethiopians, the Israel, our people were not particularly at that spot? Isn't it a fact that the United Nations you call on found that many of our communities were ready to bring people out? And you talk about the Iranian nation to help. Also a fact that there are almost every nation in the world in Ethiopia giving assistance to people who are hungry on the northern borders of Ethiopia.
Are you suggesting that it would have been better for Israel?
No. If Israel had bring them, I was saving us for the reason that you indicated or tried to indicate, yes. Well, how is it that all of a sudden that we are saved but we wind up in the army and we die from starvation? We wind up in people's house cleaning, and you know, Palestinian women, Palestinians never let their women. This is one thing against our principle, to work as domestic in anybody's house. We're doing that now. Why didn't you mention the poor Palestinians that 2-3 weeks ago that committed suicide over this in Israel? Why didn't you mention the protest meeting in Israel? Why didn't you mention the dialogue between Israel and Ethiopia, that the Palestinians meaning they don't want to go back to Ethiopia, and there's a dialogue about the, and the Ethiopian government say, you took them, bring them back.
So the saving of lives by the state of Israel or Jews is another example of racism.
Oh, wait, if you could say it that way, okay. But if you get cheap labor, you don't have to worry about the lives.
That is the purpose at which the state of Israel
does not even
That is unworthy of a public state.
Okay, it is. But when we were dying from Muslim extermination, it is typical of the behavior of European American Jews. You don't want me to say that. Rabbi, you probably live in a racist society yourself. I couldn't probably walk in and out. You don't want me
to deal with Israel not initiated the Operation Moses. I suspect you would have been among the first who would have said, you see how racist responding to the plight of Jews, even though they're black.
It's the biggest
mistake. But now you say that even though they're black, it's a racist response.
It's outrageous. I listen to you. It's absolutely outrageous. You don't think that you're outrageous? Now, my point is this, that a nation that said we don't exist, you know, with the contrition of Israel, the thousands upon thousands of Israelis leaving Israel constantly. You need to replenish that community. You have an Arab situation, and don't you remember the third world? Because I'm not a member of the third world, I remember the first world. You know, it's in just the first place. It was long before Adam and Eve, and it's found in Africa. Lucy is found in Ethiopia, and it's 3.2 million years. You see, you want me to go along with a dialogue that it suits you as a European Jew, but doesn't suit me as an African Jew. And you assume that my African Jew is going to supersede my Africanness. No way, Rabbi, because you want it both ways. You want to be a European Jew, benefiting from being a European, getting it from being a Jew, and that I sat by and listened to it, and then call it anti-Semitic.
You may have difficulty, but the record will show that I sit here as an American Jew.
That's right.
That will be my definition,
and I have
how you choose to define me in whatever racial or political terms you have to need is your business.
I got to cut you. I thank you both for expressing your opinion so open.
Yeah.
She asked if I would assume the responsibility of responding in the name of ADL.
All right.
And that's what brings me here.
And she sent you the transcript?
Yes, indeed.
All right. What are your problems with the comments that were made by Dr. Ben in the program?
From the perspective of the ADL, we have numerous difficulties with the statements that were made, and I suspect we'll have an opportunity as the program goes on to discuss specifics. But in an overall general sense, as we study the transcript, Dr. Ben's remarks were full of clearly factual errors. But the kind of errors which were not just matters of detail, but were matters that would lead one down the path of the
charge of dual loyalty, which, as Carol Lister indicated in her her letter, has been a classic charge of the anti-Semite throughout the generations. The statement that appears in the transcript that was made by Dr. Ben, that a Jewish child makes a statement of allegiance to Israel and makes a statement of allegiance greater than even to his Americanism, is so patently false and outrageous as to make one wonder why such a statement would be made. I must tell you that before joining the staff of the Anti-Defamation League, I served as a congregational pulpit rabbi for 9 years and officiated at countless numbers of bar and bat mitzvahs in my congregations. And I must tell you that never have I heard a more inaccurate statement as to what goes on. The transcript indicates that a Jewish child commits himself that there shall never be another Holocaust, that takes upon himself political obligations, takes upon himself the responsibility to fight for the state of Israel. The reality is that in the Jewish tradition, bar mitzvah means a son of the commandments. And a boy becomes a bar mitzvah, a son of the commandments, upon his 13th birthday. A girl, in America, the practice tends to be at 12. According to Talmudic law, she reaches her majority at 12. That's portions of the letter. Well, I asked Carol Lister, who wrote that letter, she's regional director of the ADL, by inviting her to appear on Like It Is to confront Dr. Ben. Well, the ADL has accepted, and so has Dr. Ben. We'll get things right underway in a moment.
The wait is finally over. This is it.
Professor Yosef Ben Yekinen, or Dr. Ben as he is popularly known, is an Egyptologist, the author of innumerable books on African history and Egyptology, and has taught for several years at Cornell University. Rabbi Arthur Seltzer is director of the Long Island Regional Office of the Anti-Defamation League and resides in Great Neck, Long Island. Welcome to Like It Is. Maybe we can start with you, Rabbi Seltzer. Did you see the program?
No, I did not see the program, but I have studied the transcript.
Okay. How did you come to this chair today? How did that happen since you didn't see the program?
Come on, put your hands together. Come on, put them together like this. Yes. Come on, y'all. We're going to take everything that the devil knows.
Retreat from the idea that y'all are going to have political equality in the country.
But by then, many students are on black college campuses who were never supposed to be in school. And those Negroes aren't satisfied. That's where my department came from. But many people in this room understand that that student movement that emptied into the tour of the Black University Conference in 1968 and then the founding of African-American Studies Department in 1969, of which I'm so glad to hear Dr. Batiste is a proud graduate among the vanguard of that undergraduate group that came through, established that department to do something different. At the same time, African Studies at Howard continued to do something different with freed up a little bit of space to operate. They're actually able to capture some of that momentum from the late 60s, because in that same 1960 year, 1969, that's when them Negroes walk out of the African Studies Association and form the African Heritage Studies Association and say, no, we're going to negotiate with y'all, but it will be from a position of strength. Now, you have people who have real problems with that. Why? Because we love you Negroes as long as you all are our pets. And never heard this thing. But black people are no longer inclined to be pets. No longer inclined to be the favorites of certain foundations and the sprinkling of a nickel here, and we're going to give everybody else $100. No, we are going to try to establish an independent beachhead out of which to operate. And AHSA ends up meeting at Howard subsequently to kind of put that together. After studies at Howard is at the center of that conversation. Now, I'm going to make a turn to conclude because I'm very mindful of about five minutes. I want to make sure. No, ma'am. Because really, the important thing I think about these moments is, however short we have, is the question and answer conversation. Because I take notes the whole time. I'm learning about that because, you know, we teach and I'm in the classroom. I think our undergraduate students particularly need to know this material. Hanbury is still, you know, passed away in 1965, but his presence is still felt at Howard, but it's marginal, the way that the Dodson says, not institutionalized. It's very important to understand that, because had it been institutionalized, we would have been light years ahead in every academic field. In every academic field. You know, and let's not even get to the small board academic politics. I mean, does Alain Locke support Hanbury's Fulbright? So you can get him out of the country because they're about to make this pitch for African Studies and they don't want the Negro even around on the soil. Frazier, who has done so much important work, he, Ralph Bunch, Abram Harris, these guys, and insurgents kind of saying that divorce isn't radical enough, but yet and still in the mid-50s was dared to tell the foundation that, you know, you don't worry about Hanbury, I got that. But African Studies still provides a core out of which emerges scholarship that transforms the way we think about so many different approaches to the study of Africa. At the same time, in 1970, after the students have unceremoniously kind of dumped, or allegedly dumping the James neighborhood, which is kind of sad. I mean, it's in a generation, you know. But then James Sheik shows up, hires Andrew Billingsley, and then you see Ron Walters come here, George Zadner come here, Robert Hill come here. There's going to be another wave in the 1970s, and African Studies rides that wave as well. And then you see some of the folks who were sitting in this room who were recruited into that same conversation. Now, and where is now? In 2013, I know from where we are in African American Studies, several years ago we went through this whole program with you. You know, the first thing that everybody always wants to do is say black. Okay, so let's put all the black together. That usually means that white HWCUs, historically white college universities, if you got an African Studies department and an African American Studies department, you just say black and then stick Afro-Diasporic World Studies of the whole black thing together and say, okay, that's beautiful. That's what they do. But what do you do with it at a black school? And not just any black school, the school that has led this conversation. Well, the way we think about it is, in Afro-American Studies, we're the unit that doesn't have to be big, because our whole reason for existence is to theorize the possibility of reconstructing discipline. And for that, that's for two reasons. Number one, to have our own academic discipline with methodology, inquiry techniques, and deal with that. So we don't that in itself is a step, eventually, to getting rid of all the disciplines. But you got to have that first step, which means language training. We're the only university, HBCU in the country, probably the university, where you can say ancient Egyptian language. Hanbury would have had a ball now. We got the only Egyptologist of African descent training as they in the world on our people. So now you can take all the forms of the classical language. But the second reason, if I conclude, I think is very much important for African studies at Howard and history at Howard and economics at Howard and all the other academic fields every one of those fields must mount and continue to mount an insurgent campaign to destroy those disciplines. As we stand here in Mr. Jefferson's library and everything that's been added since. Just like this library has its founding template, places that I've stood in many times, and I'm so glad you hear from Kemet, from Egypt. Those first libraries that they call Pharaoh in the ancient Egyptian language, it's not the first library. It's an important library. It's an extension of a literary tradition. But what the academic field at Howard must do is reclaim human knowledge in all of those disciplines. And there's no more place, no more important place to do that than the place that is marked by its study literally of the African continent and the extension of Africa throughout the diaspora. And that is the Department of African Studies. I'm going to start with that. Maybe we can have more questions. Thank you.